PT Final Exam is an awesome resource for students preparing to take the National Physical Therapy Exam. Visit them online at ptfinalexam.com/pintcast. That's ptfinalexam.com/pintcast.
This is the PT Pintcast, a podcast that talks about physical therapy over beer. Bringing together clinicians, researchers, and forward-thinking PTs in a show that's anything but boring.
Let there be beer!
This is the PT Pintcast with your host, Jimmy McKay.
All right, the next episode of the PT Pintcast starts right now. Our guest tonight specializes in clinical management of patients with both acute and chronic orthopedic injuries in the outpatient environment. His practice is focused on integration of manual therapy and exercise into a holistic, evidence-informed, and biopsychosocial approach to physical therapy treatment. He's a rehab manager and residency director for a hospital system in Houston, Texas. He is the owner and program director for Optum Manual Therapy, COMT, and fellowship programs. He was honored by the Texas Physical Therapy Association Southeastern District as the Clinical Instructor of the Year. He earned his APTA board certification in orthopedic physical therapy and is also a fellow in the American Academy of Orthopedic and Manual Physical Therapists. He has served locally as a delegate for the TPTA and nationally on the American Board of Physical Therapy Residency and Fellowship Education Credentialing Council for the APTA. Welcome to the Pintcast tonight, Dana Tu. Dana, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jimmy. Very, very excited to be here. You've got me blushing already.
Cool thing is, now we're pushing this out. We've got some other students from around the country in different PT programs, and so we've got some help. You know, myself and Tom Storm are two students from Marymount. Now we've got Rachel German, Molly Main. We've got some other kids coming in, and so you're blushing because those girls are all over Twitter pushing questions out to get a little bit of buzz before the interview. So we got some good questions coming up in the show too from students and PTs around the country. You know, your area of expertise is residencies and fellowship, but the first question is always the hardest on the show. Well, what are we drinking?
I know that, you know, you're kind of big into craft beer and sort of drinking a new beer each time, so I thought I'd throw something a little bit different at you. Tonight we're drinking a Budweiser Select.
I have not had that on the show just yet.
This is my go-to. You know, they drink a lot of different craft beers and everything, but Budweiser Select is always my go-to.
Yeah, see, undergrad you drank whatever you could afford, and I never really judge anybody on their beer because I think you should drink what you like. You know, I'm not a real hipster of the room. The only reason I drink a different beer with each episode is I like to try different stuff. But if it's just me and some buddies drinking by the pool or, you know, going out in the backyard, I typically drink what I like. Now, I'm never going to say no to a sip if someone's got something I've never tried, though.
What's your go-to?
Well, I mean, if we're going to drink a lot of beer, I'm probably just the Silver Bullet kind of guy, Coors Light, keeping it
there
simple
because
I don't want to be too heavy at the end of the day. I like the Leinenkugel Summer Shandy is my summer beer, but I could drink that in the winter, too.
That's a good one.
Tonight, we're going something I've never tried before. It's from Green Flash. It's the Tangerine Soul Style IPA India Pale Ale infused with tangerine. So I have no idea where this is going to go. So cheers to Dana for coming on the show tonight. Appreciate it, man.
Cheers, Jimmy.
All right. So very first episode that's actually not that bad. Hitting the tangerine right just night. First episode we ever had was with our good friend, Cookie Friedhoff Bowman. I wanted to interview somebody that I knew really well. Do you know Cookie?
I love her.
It's tough not to know Cookie because her personality is bigger than the room. That's why I wanted to lead off with her when we launched this podcast. Plus, you know, I was comfortable with her. There was nothing I could throw at her that she was going to get intimidated about. So that made me feel at ease. So we talked about residencies and fellowships, and that was about a year and a half ago when we recorded that. We just talked about what they were. And even though I did that, and I've talked about residencies and fellowships with people, I struggle to wrap my mind around what it actually is. So I want to start from the start, the easy stuff. What is a residency or a fellowship? If someone says, what is this thing that is a residency or fellowship?
I did a little bit of math today, and I was kind of looking at sort of where we are. We've got 204,000 licensed PTs in the U.S. We've got about 3,000 graduates. So what that equates to is 1.5% of all therapists have done either residency or fellowship. So It started in 79 at Kaiser, but we've really only been tracking graduates since 1999. So this is still, you know, really new to our profession. So that's a great question, you know. So I get it all the time. I get it for students and they're like, you know, I just don't know. Should I don't want to go to school anymore. I'm sick and tired of school.
I'm right there.
Right. Yeah. And I'm like, this isn't school anymore. You're in the clinic 40 hours a week. At the same time, though, we build in an extra 4 hours a week where you're doing some didactics. So you're in the lab, you know, we used to kill people with PowerPoints and we used to sort of do that, but we don't do that anymore. Now it's very lab-based, it's very application-based. So roughly 4 hours a week are didactics. You get 4 hours a week of mentorship from someone that's an expert. It's basically, as a PT graduate, we're generalist. And now this is a deep dive into becoming a specialist. 150 hours of one-on-one mentorship time with someone that's an expert in the field. At the same time, you know, 4 hours a week of didactics throughout the entire year. So it's just a much deeper dive, making you a specialist in whatever area that you want to go into.
Already you're setting this up. It doesn't sound as scary as what I originally thought, because I'll be completely honest, we went into it with Cookie, but I don't think she set it up like that. Now, is that how yours is set up, or is that how most of them are set up, with 4 hours of classroom stuff and then 4 hours of mentoring with someone set up for you who knows about that area?
The programs can go any direction that they want to go, but there is sort of a minimum bar. And I see most of the programs being on the credentialing council. The minimum bar is about that. Now, you can deliver the didactics online if you want to, and then just have a couple exams, or you can deliver it sort of 100% in the clinic. You know, there's a lot of different varieties of programs, but that's generally it, you know. So you're in the clinic, you're a professional 40 hours a week, and you've got other people there, you know, but you're it. And then you're still a student just a little bit. Not so scary, something that's definitely doable the way that the APT has got it set up right now.
It doesn't sound as scary. Does this come from the medical model? Does this come from physicians in terms of doing a residency and then further on and doing a fellowship? Is that where we kind of picked this up not long ago in the spectrum, in the realm of PT?
Their model is different, and I don't know if we should strive for that model, but the APTA does do a lot of benchmarking. So they're trying to find out sort of what models are out there, what model fits us best, what model is going to be accessible to the most PTs, you know, because that's the deal, right? It's great to have all these programs, but if you don't have PTs that are interested in doing them, you know, what good is that? Yeah, that's definitely something that we look at, but it's not near as intense. So my residents work 44 hours a week, and then depending on sort of what module they're in, they're about 5 to 10 hours of study at home. Whereas residents in the medical model, they actually have to limit them to 80 hours a week in the clinic.
No, thank you.
Yeah, right. And they can only work 7 days straight, and then they get 24 hours off. And we're not there, and we don't need to be there.
I don't think that'd be a good model to learn anything on the fly, right? I mean, that sounds like if you put that job on Craigslist, no one's going to take that, right?
No. The salaries are vastly different, and that's something that we're going to have to tackle too. This year at House of Delegates, we're talking about student debt, and then at the same time, we're talking about should maybe residency be mandatory. Those are two sort of ideas that are on the opposite end of the spectrum. Like, how do you manage debt at the same time add to debt? Those are two things.
We just lengthened things not long ago, really. I mean, a heartbeat ago, transitioning to the doctorate level and adding pretty much a year onto school, which added some more cost. This leads to my next question. This is what I had in my chamber. Should all PT students eventually have to do a residency? Will this one day be the norm in the near or distant future? Is that what the APT is driving at?
Yes. I think so. We're a long ways from that, though. So it was brought forward by California at the 2014 House of Delegates. Basically, they wanted the APTA just to look into it, see what it was going to take, see what year, what timeline, you know, all of that. So APTA is going to report back in 2017 at the House of Delegates, and they're going to tell us. They're going to talk to, I think, 40 or 50 clinicians. They're going to talk to students and sort of see what it looks like. But we're not there yet. Each year we graduate 8,000 therapists. Currently there's 220 residency programs, 42 fellowships. So if you do the math right there, it's going to be about 36 people per program. I've got four.
Not enough seats. We're playing musical chairs. A lot of people are going to be left standing.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's not a good model yet. So we don't have enough programs. I mean, even the medical programs, if you look at orthopedic surgery fellowships, they generally admit 4 to 5 people per class. We're not there yet, but the rate that applications are coming through, we're not far from it. And the APTAs, they got a little bit of flack this year from some different programs of whether they should sort of go through credentialing again because it's a lot of work. And so there's some growing pains, but we're definitely moving in the right direction.
It's going to take a while, especially because you got to make them all up to par.
That's it. That's exactly it. You know, the mentorship has to be there, the curriculum, all that's got to be in place.
Well, you said the magic M word, which if you jump on Twitter and you're a student PT, just do any hashtag that has to do with PT students, hashtag DPT student, and you're going to come across mentoring. And I brought this up several times, and I think speaking just for myself as a student about to graduate, I hear that word mentoring. And I think, you know, right now I've got a really great CI, and I don't want to kiss her butt too much. She'll think I'm trying to get extra points right now. But, you know, I've got a really great CI. I'm there. I'm on my own, but I've still got the bungee cord attached, and I've got someone who's pretty much dedicated to me in the clinic. I can ask her a question at any time. So that's, to me, that's what mentoring is. She's right there for me. And now in a couple months, I graduate, and all of a sudden that bungee cord is cut, and I hope I got a chute packed, right? And I hope I land somewhere good in a good clinic where I can ask my, you know, my colleagues and ask them questions, and they'll be there for me. A lot of places when you go for jobs, I'm learning this as I go on interviews, say we offer mentoring. You know, we've got a great staff and mentoring. So let's just start from the start again. What's mentoring? Where can I find it? And I feel like I definitely need it. So I want to know where it is.
Mentoring is started in the biblical days. It's been around forever, you know, with Barnabas and Paul and Timothy and Titus.
Oh, we're going Old Testament now. I like that. We're going to the roots.
You said you went to some private schools.
So. I went to Catholic school, yeah. St. Bonaventure and Marymount, both Catholic. We'll go to the roots, man. Let's do it.
It's something that's ingrained into us that we want a mentor. So as a leader, you need a mentor. And as a new grad, you need a mentor. And hopefully it's somebody that's not too far removed from you, right? So just maybe a step ahead. And then if you're a leader, maybe just a step behind and a step ahead. That's what everybody's looking for. When you go to the airport, you look on the shelves, you know, there's all the bestsellers and it's self-help books, right?
Everybody's looking. That's right.
That's what we're all looking for. So, of course, the employers know that, right? They know that you're looking for mentorship. So that's a good selling point. But what does that actually look like in the clinic, right? Does it look like you're working, you're slammed between patients, you're trying to get your documentation and you can yell a question at somebody? Or does someone actually sit down with you and observe you treating patients? Do you have that lifeline?
What do you consider a good mentorship then? I mean, I'm guessing it's more of the second, someone who's going to take a few hours at least, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it's a lot more than a lot of people have. And that does, if they're going to dedicate 4 hours, you can see 4 1-hour patients, or you can see 8 30-minute patients. Is pretty good, especially if you get to pick and choose who you're seeing. If you know you're having a difficulty with this particular type of patient or this particular patient, that seems like a lot. That seems like something that'd be really valuable, especially for a fresh PT.
Yeah, I think so. The expectations as a DPT are way higher than they were 20 or 30 years ago. So 20 or 30 years ago, you could treat a patient for an hour, and you're fine. Now the expectations are that you're a doctor, you've got 30 minutes, and you're talking to a much more educated patient, right? So everybody's educated on Wikipedia and
WebMD.
So the people that we're talking to are much more educated, so the expectations are so much higher. You know, so you do 32 weeks or so in the clinic, and you're expected to be it, right? That's it. You go on the floor, and that's it. You know, you've got some journal articles you can pull from, but, you know, that's it. The way that we structure our residency program is that we start with 6 to 7 hours a week of mentorship, and then we go down to 5, and we go down to 4. It's sort of, you really sort of front-end load it. There's a lot of ways to mentor. There's not one sort of method. The method I think works best is you get to know your student, you get to know your residency, the ins and outs. Are they introvert, extrovert, ambivert? You know, you really get to know their, you know, how they want to learn. Do they want to be challenged on the spot? Do they want to sort of pull away at the midpoint like you kind of do in PT school? What's going to be the best method? You got to be empathetic. You got to do the feedback sandwich. You got to give them some action items. There's not one way to mentor. I've seen some bad mentoring and I've seen some great mentoring. If you just go through PT school and you're never mentored by an expert, you may not know that it exists. When I finished PT school, I was mentored by some great people, but none of them were board certified.
I was going to say, you're an Aggie, right?
I'm an Aggie.
I like that. I want to throw that. I want to make sure you got that in there. I know you guys are proud of that down in Texas.
Man, we are. We got big gold rings. And yeah, I got to tell you about that. When you get your ring, you put it into a pitcher of beer. And the deal of it is you drink the entire pitcher of beer. You catch the ring between your teeth. And then your buddies record how much time it takes you. And that's sort of the standard. So that happens the end of your junior year. So it's called Aggie Ring Dunk.
I think I would like to start that as some sort of tradition for this podcast. So you and I need to talk off air. And we got to think of something that we need to catch between our teeth after we pound a pitcher of beer. I like that a lot.
Yeah, it's a great tradition.
So that's the model that you're working with, but you were saying that when you were in PT school, you didn't have, because that wasn't the norm, you didn't have anybody that you studied under that was board certified. So how did you trip and stumble upon mentorships and fellowships, and then you went out and created your own eventually?
Completely on accident. I graduated PT school from a great PT school, Texas Women's University. I thought I knew it all. My mentors, my CIs, you know, they challenged me a little bit, but usually I had had good answers for them. So I knew that I wanted a job, and I wanted a job where there were some people that I respected. And it just so happened that they were starting a residency program. So I applied. There was four of us. So they accepted two. I got one of the positions. I'm like, all right, well, I'm here, but it's just my job to prove to them how much I know. Mm-hmm. You can't be mentored if you know it all. And so it took me a little bit. I had a chip on my shoulder. It took me a little bit. And then finally, I figured out, like, hey, these people are here for me. You know, they're investing a lot of time to build me up, to get me to a better place. So then I started to open up a little bit, you know, sort of being vulnerable, you know, being vulnerable to learn. That's really where I got a lot of that mentorship from.
And I'd be a bad podcast host if I didn't mention how you can find out more about Dana online and his program. You can check him out on optimfellowship.com. That's O-P-T-I-M fellowship.com. And you can follow him on Twitter at Dana2. That's D-A-N-A-T-E-W. So how did you go from tripping across a mentorship program, coming out of it, and then saying, you know what? I could start my own. Let's do that. How does one even go about coming up with the idea that it's a good idea to start your own?
That's a good question, and I'm still not sure I know the right answer for it yet. Being mentored really, I think, changed my trajectory as a PT.
You know, what does that mean? What do you mean? Where do you think you'd be right now if you didn't have the mentoring that you did and the program you went through?
I'm thinking down by the river in a van sort of thing. But I think the residency really made me a physical therapist. I think that's where it happened, and that changed the trajectory. You know, so then I became involved in the section. I became involved in chapter, House of Delegates, took my board certification and fellowship. So I got to that place fairly quickly. I've been a PT for 6.5 years now. So I got there pretty quickly. And I just think that if you don't go that route and you just go sort of your own gratuitous route, you know, you're not going to end up in the same place. I mean, guys like you that, you know, you're probably going to end up there regardless, right? But there's not a lot of guys like you. You know, how many people in your class are doing what you're doing right now? So for the vast majority of us, we have to you know, sort of get that structured mentorship to get there.
Yeah, my buddy from one earlier episode, he went to SUNY Upstate, my friend John DeNoyles, and then he did a residency and went to Sacred Heart in Connecticut. And he said in multiple occasions, both sober and drunk, that doing a residency was one of his best ideas ever. And I think he came up with the idea probably when he was drunk. John likes his beers, but he said it did. He felt it put him, anyway. He doesn't say it translates for everybody, but he said it progressed him about 5 years. He felt he grew a lot, and he wouldn't change that, even though he said it was difficult to, and he had a wife and a young baby at the time. So students at different points in their lives and careers have to take that into consideration, but it is part of that path of professional growth, because I think we're very, very structured, as you mentioned. As unstructured as I typically am about learning things, I do like that structure. I kind of adhered to it in PT school. So yeah, in a month it goes away, and then everybody's going to be saying, well, you know, that whole big, well, now what? So professional growth, you know, we wanted to talk about that too. Is that something that a residency and fellowship is really going to instill upon you? Because you still get to be a student. You still get to be a little bit fallible and vulnerable, like you said, but you have a little bit of a safety net. You've got that mentor. You've got that thing to fall back on. That's, you know what, I'm still learning, and that's okay, because I'm doing this to be better.
It's all about exposure and modeling those behaviors. You know, once you've seen someone do it that's not too far removed from where you are, you're like, wow, you know what? I can do this. This isn't too outlandish. You know, I can run for a position on the local chapter. I can maybe even think about running for a national position. You know, you've got to see those behaviors modeled in front of you, somebody that you respect and that will sort of talk you through the process. But once you see that, you know, it sort of lowers a lot of barriers that you would put up that may be unjustified.
So postgraduate education, I love this. We wanted to talk about this. I saw this topic come up and I said we definitely have to get into it. Postgraduate education, talking about Con Ed courses, why intervention-based courses are sexy but not effective. What does that mean to you? Get into that.
So part of the COMT program that I host, I'm big into the mentorship component. You know, so you see a lot of COMT courses out there, but because it's sort of just classwork or it's all online, there's no mentorship. So what we do is weekly, we do mentorship online through Zoom call, and I'll have 10 or 12 people in my program, and they'll present these case studies, and everybody can kind of chime in. You know, we all sort of talk about these cases. And the question always comes up is, well, did you try this method? Did you rub the sharp thing on the skin? Mm-hmm. Or did you needle? Or did you try this technique? And that's where everybody wants to go with it. You know, you learn these things at the CU courses, and, you know, they're sexy and they're popular, but they don't go into the actual assessment. They don't go into knowing the patient a little bit better. Did you talk to your patient about home life and what's going on with their kids and stress at work? Are they having to take care of a grandma? Are they working? Have they lost their job because they can't work anymore? You don't go into any of this stuff. It's all about those interventions. So the reason why I say, you know, CEU courses are ineffective is Julie Fritz did a study on it a few years ago. We forget things. We forget things fast, right? So you go to it, you learn a new technique, and 2 weeks later, you might be doing it on one patient, and then 3 weeks later, it's gone. So the reason why residency programs, you know, like this work is because you're learning things weekly, and then you're applying it the next day, and then you're held accountable for it.
Well, I think I downloaded some stuff from your website, just doing some background, and again, it's optumfellowship.com, and I liked how the first thing I came across that was downloadable on your blog was just something that was really a method, I guess, really going into how you guys had thought, more of a thought process and less of a thing to do, more of a treatment paradigm, and I downloaded that, and I saved it, because that's what I do. I just find stuff on the internet. I'm like, well, I'm going to steal that. Maybe I'll use it later. But it was cool, because I also liked it, because you mentioned PowerPointing people to death by PowerPoint, and this treatment paradigm. Whenever you hear a paradigm, you think, oh, this big, massive way to think. Yours was one page. It was a couple bullet points, and each one had one or two things under it, and it was super easy to follow. So is that typically how your residency and fellowship programs work at Optum? It's more of a how do you think, how do you approach thing, and less on how to do the sexy manip or the cool intervention?
So I got to give props to my mentor and my first residency director, Brian Duncan, because that whole paradigm was kind of his child. You know, we've tweaked it, and we've talked about it a lot. To us, that's sort of idealistic, right? You know, so you've got 30 minutes to treat a patient. So when you have that paradigm in front of you, it's really just a way to sort of purposely manage a patient in an order sort of that makes sense. I work in a uninsured, you know, a lot of them come from Mexico. They just don't have a...
Because you're down in Houston right now.
Right. So that's the population, very much chronic pain. The way that I'm going to go through that paradigm is going to be way different than the way that Brian Duncan's going to go through the paradigm. He works in a sort of a sports-oriented, he runs a sports residency and also an orthopedic residency, all insured patients. So the way he's going to go through that paradigm is going to be way different than ours. The big thing is, you know, we do it several times throughout each treatment, is just rechecking that asterisk sign, you know, making sure that what you're doing is working the way you want it to work and making sure that it's meeting the patient's expectations. So it just kind of goes through sort of each thing that you could possibly do, but put some in a thoughtful order.
I like that, because I've said before, and I'll say it again, I've got a short attention span, and I want to be doing, I'm going to be moving, I want to be seeing stuff. And I liked how several times through that, it's that reassessment of asterisk sign or functional movements, and you're just looking at that over and over and over again. It goes along with actually what my friend John DeNoyles was talking about for the topic of his episode, which was test, treat, and retest, which is you're always going after it. And I remember my first affiliation, I thought, wow, a half hour. I've got to talk with the patient and figure stuff out and do stuff for a whole 30 minutes. How am I going to keep coming up with stuff? And now that I'm in my third, it is cool to feel, wow, that 30 minutes just goes by so quick. I wish I had more time with that patient because I would do so much more. So it is cool to see how your PT, your manual therapy treatment paradigm in that flow gets it done in a thought process and not do A, then do B, then do C. It's more, hey, start out by thinking this, and then it's more like a tree. Go left, go right. What happens when you go left, go right? Because not every patient is going to fit an ABC model. In fact, pretty much no patient is going to fit an ABC then C model. So it's cool to see something like that, especially when you're talking about why you should go for a residency or fellowship, which is come here, we're going to walk you through how we think, you're going to watch us do our thing while we think, and then we're going to watch you as the student do that thing that we just taught you in terms of how to adjust your thoughts and how to order things. So that makes residencies and fellowships a little less scary for me. I'll be completely honest with you. I'm not as intimidated by buy them, especially the thought of, oh man, more school and more learning.
Absolutely. And, you know, kind of like the premise of your podcast, and you say that like the most meaningful discussions happen during happy hour. In residency, the most meaningful growth and development happens when the patient is in front of you, right? And so if you can be mentored on that as a professional, you know, that's a great place to be. A typical resident experience, getting a couple thousand hours of didactic experience, they're getting 150 hours of one-on-one mentorship, reading 100 plus articles. They're helping teach at, you know, local PT schools. They get a student and they get mentored on how to be a good clinical instructor. You know, so we really just try to frame that first year just to change the trajectory, change that person, change behaviors, change practice, because behaviors and practices don't change with CEU courses. You know, you learn that sexy skill and they kind of, that's it. We get that question a lot. It's like, well, what paradigm do you follow? What guru do you sort of, you know? And it's not about that. You know, it's about the patient. Now, when I went through my fellowship, if you had a spine, I wanted to pop the thing, you know, and if you didn't get better, I'm like, what's with you? You're crazy. Right. And what we were starting to find out is it doesn't matter what we do. As long as we connect with the patient, we find out what their expectations are. And we look at, you know, sort of what our clinical skill set is, mix a little bit of exercise with it. We're probably going to be okay.
You mentioned our tagline, the best conversations happen at happy hour. Welcome to ours. A couple of my patients, because we've discussed the fact that I ramble on with a podcast about PT, we've talked about it in a couple of the clinical settings that I've been in. Several of the patients on more than one occasion have said, if PT served beer, I would come more often and I'd probably be more excited to show up. So I'm pretty sure it's not a great idea, but you know, if something falls through in my career, maybe I could use it as one of my sexy gimmicks.
You know, I think, was it the APTA that they looked at sort of the hashtag physical therapy, and they were looking at sort of all the mean things people say about physical therapy, and then they've done it like on Jimmy Kimmel's show and all of that, but maybe we need to do it sort of on the other side, right? Let's find all the positive things and find out how we can do it better. So maybe it's serving beer, right? We'll see.
I mean, the taps are open. Let's do it. You were given an award for being a great CI, Texas Physical Therapy Association Southeastern District Clinical Instructor of the Year 2013. Congratulations to that. So clinical education, you're open enough to take students, which I applaud you for, because without people like you, we'd all be lumped into affiliations, and I like that one-on-one time. So without more people taking students, that goes to one-on-two, one-on-three, and then I think a little bit less learning happens. So clinical education, how's that near and dear to your heart?
That's it, man. That's where it comes from, you know. And if you can inspire a patient to get better, and then the next step is inspire, you know, students and other professionals, I mean, that just does it for me. The whole reason we started residency and fellowship is because we had such good experience with students, right? We were taking in a lot of students. We've got a big clinic and we had pretty good success with students. We loved it. For me, started taking on students, really enjoyed it. Started taking on residents, really enjoyed that too. I really tried to employ sort of, I don't know if you've read this book, but like the love languages.
Oh, yeah. There's like six different, you like, you know, you like touch, you like hearing, you like acts of doing.
Yeah. Right.
Wait a minute. I knew that answer way too quick. I'm sorry. I dated a girl way back in the day who was like, you need to take this quiz. And I was like, I don't know about quizzes, but I should have just said no. I had no idea. So yeah, tell me more about that, Dana.
Well, so you probably don't want to touch your students too much, but
not a good reason to be a CI.
Not a good reason at all. No, don't go that direction. Just like, you know, Mike Connor said at the House of Delegates, you probably don't do your dentist, but you do physical therapy. It's kind of strange, but you know, getting to know your resident, and getting to know your students. Do they like time? Do they like praise? Do they really sort of acts of service? You know, really get to know the student, get to know the resident, sort of what makes them tick, and, you know, get to know them as a person. I just don't think a lot of CIs will invest that much time. And what we see out there a lot is clinical experience, but you don't see a lot of clinical instruction. That's the part that's missing, you know, in a lot of the clinical education that's offered. So if you don't get good clinical instruction, that residency is going to really change, you know, how you're practicing.
I think that's a good point. I lucked out, and I will say thank you to the three full-time CIs that I've had, and we do at Marymount University. We do a bunch of integrated clinicals for a couple weeks here and there. And my CIs have been great, Cam, Kevin, and Lisa, just all really, I lucked out, because I've heard some stories from classmates or from students at conferences, and I've heard some scary situations where they're not really learning a lot, and I actually find myself kind of biting my tongue in that situation, and not telling them about my situation, because I'm like, yeah, mine's nothing like that, mine's a lot of fun, I learn a lot, and I like it, and it's a low pressure and high learning environment, so I typically keep my mouth shut. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to go to Twitter and Facebook and answer some questions, because you being the guy for residencies and fellowships, it comes up a lot, especially with students, especially as we get closer to the end of PT school. So we're going to jump on Twitter, if that's cool with you.
Absolutely. Let's do it.
Back in a minute with Dana too on the PT Pinecast. Don't move.
We talk PT, drink beer, and record it. This is the PT Pinecast.
PT Final Exam is an awesome resource for students preparing to take the National Physical Therapy Exam. 6-week online review courses with live webinars, personal attention from instructors through email, phone, or Skype, and practice tests. Choose from their Mastermind Study Group or the NPTE Home Study Bundle. Visit them online at ptfinalexam.com/pintcast. That's ptfinalexam.com/pintcast.
Follow us on Twitter at PT Pintcast and online at ptpintcast.com. It's like TMZ, except with way more important information. And no Miley Cyrus. Okay, it's not like TMZ at all.
All right, we're back with Dana, too, on the PT Pinecast. The best conversations happen at happy hour. Welcome to ours. You can find Dana on Twitter at Dana2, that's D-A-N-A-T-E-W. And check out information about his residency and fellowships online at optimfellowship.com. That's O-P-T-I-M fellowship.com. We're going to jump into a new section. We've done Q&A before, but now we've got a fancy name. This is how we radio things. You've got to give it a cutesy name. So let's go online to find some questions in a new feature we like to call AA. That's ask and answer, of course. So you start like this. Hi, I'm Jimmy, and welcome to AA. So we go to Twitter. I'd be bad classmate if I didn't go to one of my classmates from the first-year class at Marymount University first. Heather Latier, she wants to know, when do you need to start considering doing a residency? When do you need to start thinking about it? Because Heather, I know, is a first-year, now rising to a second-year. Does she need to start thinking about it right now?
It's not a bad time. You know, start doing some research. And I saw her on Twitter, so she's definitely doing some networking and finding out which programs are going on. And I think that's a great way to start. I mean, you don't need to start applying or anything like that, but you do need to start looking at sort of which part of the country you want to look at, you know, which clinicians are at which residency program. So it's a good idea just to start taking some mental notes and kind of preparing yourself to go that route. So really just sort of just look and see what's out there. If you already know which specialization, which area you're going to go into, then you can really just sort of narrow it down.
That's cool. Follow-up question from her, and this is also one I like to ask, but I'm going to ask it in two ways. She wants to know, what to you makes a good qualified or desirable applicant? When you see someone on paper or you get them in front of you in an interview, what are some things, maybe like the top two or three things that jump out at you to say, yeah, this person's going to do really well in a residency or a fellowship?
One quick thing. So if you're, let's say you're a third year, right, and you're ready to apply, most programs, applications are due sort of December, January. We're not quite like medical schools yet. We don't have like a match day or like a residency interview day. Most of the schools in Houston will interview February, March, make decisions around there and start in September. You know, just something to think about if you're a little bit further along.
Gotcha.
What makes a good applicant? I don't look at your GPA at all from PT school, right?
Awesome. Good. I'm in so far.
You know, so everyone, you know, they graduate with a similar skill set, you know, and it's just luck of the draw where you got your clinical instruction from, you know. So I don't look at any of that. For me, I've got a very specialized population. So I want to know that you're in it to treat these people, right? So we treat 45% Spanish speaking population. They're underserved. They're underinsured. They don't have a lot of resources. They need a lot of help. So you've really got to have a heart, you know, for that kind of service, you know, for my program. Know what you're getting into. And then what separates you from your other classmates? You know, have you been a student, you know, delegate? Have you been on the student assembly? Have you done any mission trips? You know, what have you done really just to show that you're sort of invested in this? I don't do a mock eval. I don't find a lot of utility in that. I just don't.
That's got to be high stress on the applicant, man.
Oh, gosh. I can't imagine.
Blood pressure's high.
I would have fumbled all over the place. I would have never gotten in. I do want to see how they perform under stress. So what we do is we do four interviews. So the first day they come in, I sit down with them. I sit down with 10 of them. So this last year, I had 35 applicants. I interviewed 10 people. I sat down with them. I showed them sort of the ins and outs of my program, what residencies are all about. They spent half the day in the clinic with my residents. They ate lunch with my residents. They spent, you know, time with the faculty and really felt things out sort of in an informal manner. Second day is where the stress comes in. So we do four interviews, three interviews with two faculty per room, about 15, 20 minutes. They just ask them kind of situational questions. What would you do in this type of thing? Have you experienced a lot of conflict? How'd you deal with it? That sort of thing. And then they make it to the big panel interview. Panel interview is 8 or 10 of us.
Wow.
And it's about 45 minutes long.
That's a shooting and gallery. Wow.
It is. You know, we try to make it a little bit less stressful on them, but I mean, you can't get around it, you know, and that's where we really get to know the people. But I do know that there's a lot of stress in that situation, too, so you don't really get to know the person. But I look at letters of recommendation from CIs and professors, and then there's some questions, you know, that we ask. You know, why this program? Why residency? What's your 3 to 5 year plan? You know, that sort of thing.
Cool. Same question, but in reverse. Instead of what makes a qualified or desirable applicant, what are some things that students should look for in a program when they're trying to sort between? Let's say, you know, I want to do a sports residency or fellowship, and I've got, you know, two or three in the geographical area that I'd like to go to. How do I separate the men from the boys there?
That's a great question. Since we are doing the AA point of this talk, I just wanted to let you know that I've opened up a Real Ale Hans Pilsner, the German-style Pilsner, from the Real Ale Brewing Company in Texas.
Going two beers deep, I like it.
Yeah. So, ingredients for an optimal residency, and I like to think of it as kind of like, Texas, like the perfect brisket dry rub.
All right, give it to me.
So, lots of spices. With my program, we've got like mentor diversity. You don't want to just learn from one person, you know. Each mentor has specific skills, and they're going to be able to connect with you in a different manner, teach you some new things. Patient volume and diversity, right? So are you just seeing post-op shoulders and knees, you know, very protocol-driven? I don't think that's a good learning environment. Educational philosophy, you know, are you sort of current with the times? You know, are you talking about pain science? Are you talking about a holistic approach? Or are you talking about just interventions? Curriculum. There's a standard sort of set curriculum by the APTA. You can just go off of the current concepts that's offered by the ortho section, and you can just tell your residents, hey, just go study that, and we'll have two exams throughout the year, and that'll be fine. Or do you have a curriculum that you've sort of developed your own? Have you taken current concepts, and have you sort of meshed it into your own treatment ideas? You know, we offer a weekly quiz. There's a final exam for each module, for each body region. There's a live patient exam for each body region. So you're getting 6 live patient exams throughout the year where there's someone just watching you, grading you, you know, during those live patients exams. The culture of the clinic, right? So this is even if you don't do residency. Look at the culture. Look at the turnover rate. Everybody in our clinic, there's probably 20 orthotherapists. Everyone's board certified and or fellowship trained and they're working on it. And everybody there started as a student, and they're still there. So the turnover rate in our clinic is pretty much none unless people move out of state or has a baby and, you know, want to move in a different direction. But people there have been there since they were a student. People have been there for 20 years, and they started as a student. That's the culture that we have there. Look at that. That's huge, right? So the pay is less because we're in a community-owned system, but the culture is that people are okay with that. And then do you fit? That's the first day of our interview process, is just that sort of feeling it out, right? Is this somewhere I could fit? Do I sort of jive with these people? I'm going to have to spend the next year with these people. Do I fit in? Do they sort of match my philosophies, you know?
Could I see myself hanging out here for hours and hours for an extended period of time? The people I'd like to go have a beer with.
Right, right. If you don't want to have a beer with your coworkers, you know.
Get out.
Right, you know, life is too short.
All right, next question comes from Twitter, at Ryan Haskins, SPT. General pros and cons of pursuing a residency. Now, you've got one. You've got a residency and a fellowship, so obviously you're a little biased, but what's the marketability, the salary, the cost after that? You know, my line is always, is the juice worth the squeeze? Are you getting paid more? Or, you know, we touched on this earlier, you're definitely going to progress faster as a clinician, and is that worth it enough?
There's a lot of intangibles, right? And that's really sort of what we're talking about. We haven't been around long enough. We don't have a lot of evidence to sort of say that this is a valuable thing to do. So we're really talking about intangibles. Residency programs vary a lot. My residency program, you don't have to pay anything to get in, and that's a lot of the programs. You take an 88% salary, so basically a 12% pay cut from a new grad, because you're in the clinic for 88% of the time, you know, treating patients. Other programs will charge, you know, $10,000 to $13,000, and you have to pay, maybe you don't pay anything, but you have to work there for 2 or 3 years after you finish to sort of pay off that debt. You have to sort of, you know, figure all that into it. As far as pay, there is probably 1 to 2 years out, you're not going to notice much difference in pay. When I hire a resident, I pay them as if they've already been practicing for 2 years, when in fact they've only been practicing for 1 year. So they're already a PT2 as soon as they apply, where normally it would take you 2 years. But I think what you see the difference is at the 5 to 10 year mark. And if you look at any of your PhDs, any of your professors, you know, any of the people that you sort of respect and you look up to, chances are they've had a mentor at some area at some time in their life. Those people, they're where they are because of that experience. So I think at 5 to 10 years, you will be making more than you know, your person sitting next to you, and you're going to be at a way different spot in your career.
Your fellowship, your residency is in person. These people are on site, right there, pressing the flesh, you know, looking over your shoulder if you want that. And you guys are looking into each other's eyes, and I dig that. Even though we do most of these interviews via Skype, you know, I still like looking in this little webcam right here that I'm looking at you with, and I still like looking into your eyes. But there are some out there that are online. You can find online mentoring. You can do online residencies or fellowships. So Crystal Wolf, that's at Krista Wolf on Twitter, asks, how do you feel about online mentoring groups? And I'm going to expand on her question. How do you feel about, you know, online residencies and fellowships? What do you lose with that? What do you gain with those?
Like you said, you can't see my beautiful hazel eyes.
You miss out on Dana's eyes, damn it.
You know, so as far as an access point of view, you know, there's not enough programs out there. So we're trying to move everybody forward. So the online mentoring, the online approach, it's not a bad thing at all. You know, we're getting to a better place. The only thing that you don't get out of it is that one-on-one sort of putting your feet to the fire. We're not well-shaming or any of that, but what we are doing is, you know, you've got someone right over your shoulder that's looking at you that you're going to have to justify your treatments in front of. And then we can also see what your treatments look like, you know. So if you're doing a special test, you can tell me that you did a special test online and, yeah, it was negative or positive, but actually seeing how you perform that test. If you're doing a slump test or something like that, you know, was it good? Was the test good? You can tell me it was good, but was it actually the way it was supposed to be performed? You know, so sometimes that does make the online mentoring a little bit difficult. We'll go through these cases and I'm like, man, I've never seen this patient before. This is ridiculous. This is crazy. I kind of think if I was in the clinic with them that it might look a little bit different. I think from an access standpoint, it's definitely a good thing. We're moving people in the right direction.
Yeah, I guess it would be important for the student or the person going into it to kind of do some reflection, some self-reflection, and we do a lot of reflection in PT school, damn it.
Right.
And I can't believe I just brought up self-reflection, but I did. Damn it, they got me. But it would be good to ask, do you think I could actually work in an online mentoring group? Do you think it would actually work in an online residency or fellowship? Am I that type of person? I personally know I'm not, because you got a little bit of ADD, you know, my attention span is small, so I need someone staring me right in the eye and saying, Jimmy, do this, feel this, this is how this should feel, this is how you should move. But if you've got that sort of thing, you mentioned access to it with a lot of students and not that many residencies and fellowships, I guess it would be a good option if you can handle that question. One more from Twitter. This is from at Josh Karnowski. What is the best way to approach prospective mentor if they would want to fulfill that role? Kind of like asking if, can I be your apprentice? And that you brought up earlier about going back to biblical days. That's what it was. It used to be apprentice and master. You became an apprentice. You followed a guy around. You carried his toolbox. You watched what he did. You cleaned up after him, but you learned a little bit along the way. In this type of setting, that isn't too bad. So what's the best way to approach someone who might want to be a mentor? What are good ways to ask and find out?
A lot of times in, you know, the medical field, you hear about, well, I trained under, you know, so-and-so. I trained under Joe Smith. And you don't see a lot of that, you know, in our field, maybe a little bit of it. But finding a mentor can be hard. I listened to your podcast with Joe Black, and he was talking about connecting with people through networking, connecting with people at CSM. The Twitter thing, I'm kind of new to that, and like you said before, I'm kind of a voyeur. I don't get involved in a lot of the arguments, but you can literally just tweet Sharon Dunn, ask her a question.
Yeah, how crazy is that with Twitter? You can just write her a question at 3 a.m. and it'll get to her. It's weird.
Right. So the world is so much smaller now. I think first off, get involved in a special interest group, get involved in a section if that's the direction you want to go. Find out who's a member of that, find out who's on the board, and then you can just connect with them, you know? Find someone that has mentored before, ask them if they'll mentor you, and then set up something structured, you know, maybe an hour a week or maybe an hour every 2 weeks. You know, can we have sort of a set upon time where we're going to sit and talk? And I hear about it more and more.
And I'll say this about the American Physical Therapy Association, especially the sections, very, very forthcoming in terms of welcoming to students. I know that because I'm a member of the sports section and I've gone to a couple of the events while we're at like CSM or the next conference. Just getting in those email groups, just being able to to hear how people are thinking, that's pretty valuable right there. And I haven't heard many students say, and I've been doing what, this is episode number 88 of this podcast, I've been said no to very, very infrequently. So people are very, very, in this field anyway, pretty giving with their time. I mean, I'm asking, hey, do you mind shooting the breeze with me for 45 minutes or an hour? And very infrequently people say no. And I think if you approach somebody and you say, hey, here's why I'd be interested in working with you, or I'd like to learn from you, it'd be difficult for me to visualize someone saying, no, I'm good. You know, hit the bricks, kid. I don't see that in PT too often.
Never had a student or a resident, they didn't want to teach at some point in their career. Everyone you ask, we all want to teach. We all want to be able to, you know, lead the next generation. So this is who we are as a profession. Finding a good mentor, if you ask around and if you're, you know, you connect with the right circles, it's not too tough.
All right. Well, if you enjoyed this episode and you want to get in with Dana, you want to be one of Dana's guys or Dana's girls, check him out online at optumfellowship.com, or you can follow him on the Twitter sphere at Dana2. That's DANATEW. So every episode is a pint. And before we're done with the pints, or, you know, Dana's going for two beers, he's double fisting with this episode, I like it, we do shots. So parting shots of wisdom as someone who's been educating people as a CI and a director of a residency and a fellowship, what's some parting shots of wisdom you'd want to leave with the PT world?
I think that going out as, you know, maybe even as a student, train at a county hospital. A lot of the physicians, they do their training at county hospitals, right? We're so limited in our access to patients in the normal sort of route of training that we do. Everyone's insured and everyone's got, you know, lots of resources. Train on the sick population, you know, and used to they would say, you know, train on the inpatient side, you know, that way you get to see sort of these comorbidities. But we see these things on the outpatient side in the county hospital. My residents, they receive a referral, not a prescription, because we're getting referrals from medical students and medical residents. So we've got access to all their, you know, their medical records, the imaging, the meds, all of that. And we get a referral for just low back pain. We're really able to sort of practice at the top of our license in an autonomous manner. And I think that's where we should start doing some of our training at. You know, so seek these places out. Seek good people out. Seek good mentors out. I read somewhere that you're the average of the five people you associate with the most. So if you associate with some good mentors, some good CIs, you know, early on, you're going to be in a great spot. Surround yourself with good people, right? Good people with emotional intelligence, good EQ. Good EQ will outtrump good IQ any day of the week. And those people will set you on the right path.
I like that. I'm going to drink to that. Yeah, that actually goes in line with, and I can't believe I actually remember the words, because it was many moons ago when I graduated from high school, and our superintendent gave the speech, and she said, you are who you are because of the people you surround yourself with. And that's pretty much just in line with what you said. You are the average of the five people you spend the most time with. And I think that's absolutely valid. That's absolutely true. I like that a lot.
Cheers.
All right, actually, check him out on Twitter, at Dana2. And again, information about his residency and fellowship program in Houston, Texas, optumfellowship.com. Dana, been a pleasure. I like the fact that you went two beers deep on me. And just in case you were wondering, the tangerine beer went down smooth.
Man, I thought you were going to open one up with me, but I'm sure you will soon. So.
We'll crack another one sometime soon. Can't wait to meet you in person at the next conference we get to, CSM, or maybe next, or just somewhere down the road in PT world.
AOMT, we're doing a pain science talk at AOMT this year.
Where and when?
October, St. Louis.
Never been to St. Louis, but I hear they have some breweries there. I like that.
They do. They make the Budweiser Select there, so how can you not go?
How do you say no to that? All right, we'll have some more information about that event and Dana's fellowship and residency and how you can connect with those guys in the Chaser at ptpinecast.com. Just click on the blog section. Dana, pleasure talking with you, my man. Thanks for coming on the show.
Jimmy, this was a blast. Thanks again, man.
Like what you hear? Leave us a review on iTunes. It's not like our moms can keep giving us 5 stars every day. Or can they? The PT Pinecast is intended for educational purposes only. No clinical decision-making should be based solely on one source. While care is taken to ensure accuracy, factual errors can be present. Our lawyers made us read that.